This is May the 18th. Well, I announced that we would try to work on the 11th chapter of Romans tonight. And I was just looking at a little structural outline here of some of this section of Romans. I don't think I need to go through the outline. I just have it here, just the main points. But going back into 9:30 to 32, we have a question. And of course, you probably have discovered already that in this section here, Paul asks questions and then he proceeds to answer them. And so back here in 9:30 to 32, he has a question. Well, how shall we say then? And then the answer is, why the Gentiles followed not, yet they attained. Israel followed, yet they attained not. And then he gives you faith versus works. So that is one thing we want to keep in mind in here. We have grace and works and faith and works, but all through Romans we have the subject of righteousness. The righteousness that was needed by man in your first chapter of Romans, especially and on up through to the 5:12. And then you also have the righteousness of God himself revealed too. In his grace and also in his judgments. So we have questions like that. Now, going on down into the 33rd verse, we have the rock of offense. And that is scandalon. We get the word scandalous in Illinois, sort of thing, scandal from that. That was the rock of offense, something that offends. And then in 9:33 also, we have something that's repeated again a little later, and this helps on the structure. Whosoever believeth on him shall not be ashamed. And then we have in 10:1-10, Paul's prayer for Israel. And it speaks of that we spoke of that, Israel being ignorant but not submissive, and not submissive. And Paul speaks of the word of faith which we preach. Now, in 10:11, he again quotes, whoso believeth shall not be ashamed. And then over in 11:4-7, what saith the oracle or word of God? And there he has grace versus works. And then when you get to 11:9-10, you have the stumbling stone. We had the rock of offense, you see, back there in 9:33. And here in 11:9-10, we have the stumbling stone. Well, that gave you a little idea of what Paul is driving at through there. I did have something else here, and maybe I don't know how to use it. I might use this as an introduction here. It's a little quotation from a Dr. Broughton, a teacher well known half a century or more ago. One day on a train, I got to talking with a Jewish rabbi, a very intelligent man. And he said, "Do you know, the objection I have to your teaching is it is not sincere. As I read the scriptures, I read that Jesus Christ is to rule in the affairs of the earth. Don't you? Well, you know that he did not. He never got anywhere near his Father's throne nor to ruling this earth. Then how do you claim Jesus to be the Messiah? I tell you, when the Messiah comes, he is to sit on his Father's David's throne and rule this earth. And then you're going to be ashamed that you did not wait until he came." I said, "You have got the cart before the horse. You do not rightly divide the scriptures. Jesus Christ is coming again, my friend, and he is prophesied in your scriptures to come again. When he does come again, he is not coming in a manger. That is the reason you despise him. You say that I am not sincere. I say that you are not sincere, because the scriptures tell you that he is to be born in a manger and to be born of a virgin. You expected him to come with a blast of a trumpet as a king. Well, he had never seen that." I said further, "When he comes again, he is coming as you're expecting him to come, as a king. And he's going to sit on his Father's throne. And then you're going to say that the Messiah has really come at last. And he is going to say to you, 'I am the Jesus of the manger. I am the Jesus of prophecy. I am the one crucified, and I'm come back, and I'm going to sit on my Father's throne and rule this nation according to the program of heaven. Then you're going to say, oh, I wish I had accepted him before this, but since I did not, I will accept him now. Then the Jews are going to be restored, and then the great worldwide evangelistic sweep will begin. Well, that just gives you a little view of it. We've gone over these things, but sometimes a better way to say it in another word. But you can see the Jew's mistake. He sees only one side of the prophecy. And he didn't see what said about the manger because he didn't want to see that. We only read, we only believe what we want to. You know. If it doesn't please us and so on, why, we can put that out just as easy as can be. No trouble at all. Just shut your ears shut. You hear what you want to hear. And I know I can see what I want to see when I got these glasses on after a while. Although it's double, but after a while this right eye just lays down on the job and so the left one works. So you see, I can even see myself. I can see what I want to see. I get out on the road, though, that's different. I got to get the others on. Because then I'm all at once, I may see what I don't want to see, you see. And boy, it can give me a big jump because here's a car over here, it doesn't belong. So I've got to be careful. Well, that is has been Israel's problem. That a young fellow from Nazareth, the son of a carpenter, one of the poorest cities of Judah, should be the Messiah, they just couldn't accept. And that was their problem. Now, getting into this Romans 11. I say then, hath God cast away his people? Or did God cast away his people? Well, now we have to get the basis again now for that. So I take the last three verses of the chapter before so we know why he's asking that question. And he has three statements there in those three verses, three quotations. In verse 19, but I say, did not Israel know? First Moses saith, I will provoke you to jealousy by them that are no people, and by a foolish nation I will anger you. But Isaiah is very bold and saith, I was found of them that sought me not. I was made manifest unto them that asked not after me. But to Israel he saith, that's God says, all day long have I stretched forth my hands unto a disobedient and gainsaying people. Now, after all of that, witness against Israel and so on, well, then Paul asks the question, well, did God cast away his people? You would think so from the way he talks there. And by the way, notice that last one, stretch forth my hands unto a disobedient and gainsaying people. All day long. Try that sometime. Hold your hands out like that all day long. See how it works. You know, sometimes we don't stop to think of how important and how emphatic such a thing as that is. Who was it that had a hard time holding up his hands? Moses, yes. And when he let his hands down, why, of course, the enemy, the Amalekites, were getting the best of it. And when he held his hands up, why Israel got the best of it. And then how did they work it out? Yeah. I believe it was Joshua and Hur, wasn't it, that held his hands up till sundown. So Israel prevailed over the Amalekites. That is shortly after they got out of Egypt. So there's a little picture of it. It makes you think of when the Lord was weeping over Jerusalem. He said, how oft I would have taken you under my wings as, or, you know, as a hen gathers her chicks together. And you would not. Would not. See, he put it very emphatic. But Paul says, perish the thought. He hasn't cast away his people. And the proof? Why, for I also, or indeed, am an Israelite of the seed of Abraham of the tribe of Benjamin. And here I'm saved. At least that's an example. God hath not cast away his people, which he foreknew. Well, now you can take that and prove that God hasn't cast away his people today, can't you? Is that true for today, or was it true when Paul wrote it? Now, Paul wrote this a little while before the end of Acts. And at the end of Acts, we find Israel were cast away, scattered among the nations. And for 1912 years, they've been no blessing to nations. They haven't had any worship. Their temple was destroyed. And they have no message for the nations. A curse rather than a blessing. But here in Romans, when Paul was writing to them, God had not yet cast away his people. Now we'll have to look into that a little further as we go along, because there are some who think that God has cast away his people and that's the end of them. And then he says, don't you know what the scripture saith of Elias? When he maketh intercession to God against Israel, saying, Lord, they have killed thy prophets and digged down thine altars, and I am left alone, and they seek my life. Yeah, Elijah thought that the jig was up. You see, Jezebel got after him. That was his trouble. But what saith the answer of God unto him? I have reserved to myself 7,000 men who have not bowed the knee to the image of Baal. Now notice, he's reserved them. And why did he reserve them? Yes, but they hadn't worshipped the idol. See? So there is 14,000 knees that have not bowed to Baal. 7,000 men. And so, at Paul's time, you'll find the same thing is true. It looked on the surface as if a nation had gone away from God and rejected and so on, but quite likely in every community, there were faithful ones in every synagogue. And so Paul says in verse 5, even so then at this present time also, there is a remnant according to the election of grace. A remnant. Now, a remnant can have two meanings. That is, in the original, it can mean, as we use it, something that's left over or a small portion. But sometimes it can also mean a choice portion, however small or great. So there's a sort of a double meaning on it. And probably both meanings can apply here, because we know from what they say it, there's a few. Out of all Israel at the time of King Ahab, only 7,000 hadn't bowed the knee to Baal. Well, that's a pretty small bunch out of all Israel, out of a few million. So that was a pretty small remnant at that time. And as far as the seed was concerned, the true seed was only a little after that, until that had narrowed down to one. You see, Jezebel had a daughter that was just as wicked as she was, Athaliah, and she married the king of Judah. And she thought she'd kill all of her grandchildren so she could rule. And little Joash was hidden down in the temple by Jehoiada the high priest. And when he was 8 years old, they crowned him king and killed her. So that was getting down pretty narrow, just to one. So here then are some questions. Verse 1, hath God cast away his people? Verse 2, don't you know what the scripture says of Elijah? Verse 4, but what saith the answer of God unto him? And then he says that there's a remnant according to the election of grace. I see some funny things about this election and predestination and foreknowledge and so on. I got some through the mail the other day. And they miss the point so often. Just take a look back at chapter 8 and the 29th verse, 8:29. For whom he did foreknow, he also did predestinate. Now, this foreknowledge of God, in the first place, we would think of it as being simply like fortune-telling, that he knew what was going to happen. Well, there's that element in it, too. There's something better than that, because as you go through and you find the usage of this word foreknow, foreknowledge, and so on, you'll find that it has with it a purpose and love. And so, for whom he did foreknow, he also did predestinate to be conformed to the image of his Son. He does not predestinate anybody excepting who are believers. So those whom he foreknows are believers. He doesn't foreknow the unbeliever. And the Lord himself said that when he came, when he would come his second time, and there would be those who would be doing things in his name, and say, I never knew you. And there are probably a lot of people today in the world that the Lord never knew. It says that he knows his sheep, and they know him, know his voice. We've got a lot of items about this word know. And there are those who, let's see now, how is it the verse says it? Bring vengeance upon those that know not God. However, the word know can also mean acknowledge. And I was trying to think of that along. It's not far from where we find those who are alienated from the life that is in God. And of course, that would include some of the same folks. Well, now, in this verse 29 we're just looking at here, that we didn't finish that. With this purpose, those whom he foreknew, he predestinated to be conformed to the image of his Son, in order that he, that Christ, might be the firstborn, the first one brought from the grave, born again, among many brethren. It's resurrection. And that goes on. Moreover, whom he did predestinate, see, we have that word again. Him he also called. There's a calling. And whom he called, them he also justified. And whom he justified, them he also glorified. I must understand that these are past tense, but in prophetic language, you use the past tense for prophetic work. And, of course, in the Hebrew, in the Old Testament, he uses that way because there isn't any future. They don't have that tense like we have in our language. And so the prophecies speak of things as having been done. But they are so certain that you might as well say it had been done, and that's what it is with this. If he foreknows a person, then he goes through this. Of course, now I will have to put a little provision on that. You still have your own will, you know. You can refuse this.
That makes a difference. Otherwise, verse 31 is read or interpreted wrong. They say,
what shall we then say to these things? If God be for us, who can be against us? If God be for us, who can be against us? So on, yes. You see, man exercises his will so that he may become an upright, morally upright being, which he could not be if he did not have an exercise of his will. Judas had all of these things. He had the calling and so on, but he dropped out. He didn't go on with it. And I suspect we're still having dropouts today. Of course, we can't judge too much about that. Well, then here's an election, which is very similar to predestination. And this remnant has been elected by grace. And he says, if by grace, then it says no more of works. My, Paul has to bring that up again. We went through all of that way back in former chapters where he was talking about faith and works and grace and works and so on. And he has to bring it up here and repeat some of what he said before because it's so important. He says, if by grace has no more works, otherwise grace is no more grace. And if it be of works, then is no more grace. Otherwise, work is no more work. Well, what then? Another question, you see. Israel hath not obtained that which he seeketh for. All down through the millenniums, centuries, they had been studying their scriptures, they had their prophets, and they were looking for something great in the future, and they had not obtained it. Why? Because of lack of faith. But the election hath obtained it, this little remnant, and the rest were blinded. Judicially, it says blinded means hardened in your margin. Well, I don't think that anybody blinds or hardens anybody until that person first does it himself. I think there are times when God will blind a person and harden a person so he may not go the full length of his iniquity. That stops him. I suspect that we don't have no realization of how many roadblocks have been put in our way in our lives. We haven't really noticed. Been doors shut and doors open and so on. But the election has obtained it. The remnant. The rest were blinded. And then he quotes, according as it is written, God hath given them the spirit of slumber, eyes that they should not see, and ears that they should not hear, unto this day. As I said a while ago, people don't see a lot of things, you know. I remember one time in our readers in school that a man took his, I think his little nephews, out for a walk in the park. The boys were pretty near the same age. And it was one of those cold winter days, and it was dark and dreary and so on. He's kind of seeing what the boys would see. One of the boys, he just pulled his coat up around his ears and practically closed his eyes, and he was going to get this hard trip over with. The other one looking around. I don't remember all of the things that he did see, but I do remember one thing that he saw, and that was very interesting. He saw a brown cocoon on a bush. And he didn't know what that was, and so it was explained to him, so he took it home with him, cut it off very carefully, and put it away where he'd get a little warm and watched, and wasn't too awfully long until out came a nice butterfly or whatever it was. And so he was learning things. The other boy, he didn't see anything. And we have people today just like that. There are some who can see the good things in life, see the beauties of nature about them, and all that sort of thing, and other people get along there, and it's just something to pass by, and that's it. And that was the trouble with Israel. They were looking for something, yes, but not the right thing. And therefore, they got the spirit of slumber so that they wouldn't even see. And eyes that should not see and ears that they should not hear. And Paul says, up to this day. You see, when you leave your parenthesis out, but the election hath obtained it, and the rest are blinded unto this day. When you leave your parenthesis out, so you get the thing straight. And David saith, let their table be made a snare. Now, your note says that's a figure of speech, a metaphor, and their table means their material prosperity. Of course, we have figures like that in our language too, you know. When a man pays so much for board and room, what do you mean by board and room anyhow? Where does he get the board? Well, you see, that's a figure of speech that stands for the table and what's on it. And a room, well, of course, you figure that's a place where he can rest or sleep. That includes a bed, then, not just a room. And so we have lots of figures of speech like that and think nothing of them. I know, for instance, with myself, I don't know much about sports, not interested in so on. Today, I just took a look at one of the articles and I read a couple of paragraphs before I had any idea what he's talking about. That language is entirely new to me. And I just wondered in how somebody 1,000 years from now happened to dig that up and read that. And they'd have as much trouble making it out as we have some of the Old Testament to make out sometimes. Even the New is bad enough sometimes. Those figures of speech and way of saying things makes it pretty hard for us sometimes. We have to go back and compare and check and so on to see what it actually means, you see. So let their table be made a snare. What is a snare? Yes, we think of a snare as being a trap or something like that. Of course, snares, one that the Indians used, they called a snare quite a bit, was bend a sapling over and make a loop of a rope and fix a trigger on it so something coming along all at once, it'd trip it up and loop the loop on a leg and hang them up in there and they'd come along and get them. That was a snare. A pit can be a snare, too. They can dig a pit and put some sharpened stakes in the bottom of it and catch an animal that way. So there are various ones of those. And Satan has a lot of these snares that he sets along the pathway of the Christian for a trip us up and so on. So let their table be made, their prosperity be made a snare and a trap. Of course, that practically explains it. And a stumbling block and a recompense unto them. A snare, a trap, a stumbling block, and then a boomerang comes back and it'll be a recompense. Pay them back. Quite often, if a man sets a trap, you know, he gets into it himself. That's your recompense. Let their eyes be darkened, that they may not see, and bow down their back always. I kind of wondered about that. I didn't find any explanation on that. All I could think of was some old broken-down horse with his back all swayed down. That's all I could think of. Might be it is a little bit mulish. At any rate, this is quoted from Psalm 69:23. Maybe we'd better look at that and see if we can get any more light. Psalm 69:23. This is entirely different. That maybe this is it. Let their eyes be darkened that they see not, and make their loins continually to shake. And you know how people do when they fear, they can really shake. It's in this one that we have a little bit more here too. Pour out thine indignation upon them, and let thy wrathful anger take hold of them. Let their habitation be desolate. Who does that make you think of? Let their habitation be desolate. Or in the New Testament, we have that mentioned. That was that piece of land that Judas bought. Let it be desolate. And the neighbors didn't have anything to do with it a long time. They call it a field of blood. Verse 11. Another question. I say then, have they stumbled with the intent that they should fall? Well, now they have stumbled, but have they fallen? That's the question, you see. God forbid. But rather, through their fall or their stumbling, and of course, they did fall finally and haven't got up. That's the worst of it. But through their fall, and I looked for this. I didn't look far enough. But if I remember right, these two words, fall, are a different word. And I didn't go to my interlinear and lexicon and look it up. I just remember that from a long time ago. That the one meant a falling down and not getting up, and the other one a temporary one. But I just have to leave that now because I didn't look it up. But rather through their fall, whatever it is, salvation is come unto the Gentiles, for to provoke them, that is Israel, to jealousy. That's the purpose. Now you see, that is almost entirely overlooked by Christendom today. They think that the Jews began to evangelize the Gentiles at Pentecost, and that was their business all through Acts. That it was for the Gentiles' sake that they're being saved. And here Paul says why. And he's talking to Gentiles here too, partly. He says, after all, he says, you were saved for Israel's sake, to provoke Israel to jealousy. Well, I thought that the apostles were to go out into all the world and preach the gospel. Baptized in the triune name. When? That's a good question to ask. When? Have you found the answer to that one? Good. That's one big step. That's one great help. Yes, that'll be the work of the apostles in the millennium. But you see, that's all mistaken. Well, does it go back to Psalm 2 and say, ask of me and I will give thee the heathen for thy inheritance, which you see on the big banners of the missionary conventions? And again, you see, you have to say no. That is the Father speaking to the Son. He says, ask of me and I will give thee the heathen for thy inheritance. And then he goes on to say, and you'll trod them on foot, rule them with a rod of iron. That is missionary work. Oh, they never put that on the banner. They cut that right off. That's taking a text out of its context, you see, and twisting it to mean what they want it to mean. And so here. There. Salvation has come to the Gentiles for this purpose, to provoke Israel to jealousy, to get them to do something. Now, if the fall of them, that is, if Israel be the riches of the world, and the diminishing of them be riches of the Gentiles, well, how much more their fullness? Now, once before, we have spoken in here about the fullness, and it's spoken of in just very few words, when all Israel should be saved. That would be their fullness. And again, then we have to watch. Somebody say right away, well, then all of the Israelites who have ever died and are living at that time too will be saved. Well, that doesn't agree with Daniel 12:2. That many of Israel, he's talking about Israel, just there's their time of tribulation and so on. Many that sleep in the dust of the earth shall awake. Not all of them. So as far as resurrection of Israel is concerned, won't be all of them, because not all of Israel have life. They're just as responsible for having life as any Gentile. Now that brings us again here to this subject we have in Romans. We're talking here about salvation. We're talking about, well, we're getting to the idea here of an olive tree and so on. But there's nothing about life in view. That they already have. He's talking about something else. If we try to read life into this, then we can read most anything into it. But if, he says, the fall then be the riches of the world, and diminishing be the riches of the Gentiles, how much more then their fullness? That is, when Israel comes to their fullness and evangelize the world, how great a blessing they will be. And then Paul, in verse 13, for I speak to you Gentiles. Now you're getting the idea here. Inasmuch as I am the apostle of Gentiles, I magnify mine office. He's been talking about the Jews and their loss and so on, especially back there in chapter 9, he enumerated a great many things they'd had advantage in, and those things were slipping away or going. And so he's speaking to the Gentiles. He says, I don't want you folks to forget now that I still have you in mind. He says, I magnify my office. That is, I feel it's very important. If by any means I may provoke to emulation them which are my flesh, I might save some of them. Now, to provoke to emulation, jealousy, or to emulation really has the idea of being copycat. That is to at least do something somebody else is doing. For if the casting away of them, Israel, be the reconciling of the world, what shall the receiving of them be but life from the dead? That's a great jump there. Well, there may be different things on that, because at the end, the world is reconciled and Israel is all saved and so on. We do have this great resurrection, too. There are a lot of Gentiles having part in it. You see that foresowing in the sowing by the wayside and on the path. Along the thorns, and then in good ground, the last good ground we find is that great multitude of them that are saved out of the great tribulation, just before the millennium. Great multitude of no man can number. I think that's in chapter 17, or 7 of the Revelation. And so that would be something of the fullness.
Yeah. Second, right? I'd like to get some dating, as it were, on this, where Paul makes this statement here, I am apostle to the Gentiles. I mean, this is prior to Acts 28, roughly.
By 18 years prior to Acts 28, Paul was an apostle to Gentiles and preached the gospel of the grace of God, yeah, for 18 years. He had preached 9 years before that to Jews only. So that makes 27 years of his ministry during Acts.
But he was an apostle.
Mm-hmm. But apostle, but he's preached to Jews only until in Acts 13:12. And that's 9 years after the beginning, after his beginning, his conversion, his first preaching in Damascus. 9 years up until Acts 13:12, and there his first Gentile convert was Sergius Paulus, the governor of the island of Cyprus. So that was the beginning of the grafting into the Gentiles by Paul. Of course, Peter had done it a little while before that in the house of Cornelius in Judea. That is something else that some people don't see. They can't get the ministries of Paul and Peter separated. Peter was supposed to stay. All the apostles were supposed to stay in the land that was promised to Abraham. Paul was the one who was to go out and preach to the dispersed. And, of course, when he did try to preach in the land on the ground which the 12 apostles should be, why, he failed twice and had to flee for his life. So he finally understood, and God told him in that trance in the temple, he said, go far hence. Apostles of the Gentiles. That's a little bit like some other things I've been working on the last few days about dates and so on, too. We'll get that out for you sometime when we get through with some of this. We're trying to get some dates for the building of Babylon and when, how near to that are the dispersion of them and their change of the language, how near to that Abram left Ur of the Chaldees and so on. Rather interesting little story in there. So May and I were working the other day a little bit on that. May come up with something after a while. It's a little hard to find material on that. You have to go through all these genealogies and look at your table and Appendix 50 in the Companion Bible and notes and so on and get some help because those are pretty well figured out. I haven't found very much to find fault with on those. Usher's chronology was a very, very close one. And you just can't accept the dates you find in your histories, in your schools and so on. And especially after Emmanuel Velikovsky showed them up for being about 600 years off of their history in Egypt. That really, no wonder they were mad at him and tried to get all the publishers to boycott him and not print any of his books. They showed up their history was all wrong. You see, people can't take things like that as graciously as Mr. or Dr. Bullinger did, and Welch reminded him that he hadn't divided his epistle just right, and he just, right then, he accepted and said, well, I just does away with most of what I've written. When these men have written a lot of books and filled the libraries up with them and then find the thing was wrong, it doesn't take very well, it doesn't go down good. And then, to spoil all the old tradition, you know, that the Queen of Sheba was an Ethiopian, a black woman, went down to see Solomon. And she was an Egyptian queen. She wasn't colored at all. She wasn't a black woman. And not only that, but when she went back, she built a temple, a replica, and on the walls she put the pictures of the ships and all of the treasures and stuff she gave Solomon. And it's there. It'll be seen. But historians refuse to accept it because there was the old tradition, and here you find rulers in Ethiopia claiming descent back to Solomon because of all of this tradition. And it's all based on nothing. That's why we have to be so careful when we go digging back and trying to build on something that may be just some empty tradition. You got to check it. Well, we got almost to the end of this one paragraph. For if the first fruit be holy, the lump is also holy. Well, now, the first fruit be holy, the lump is also holy. I would say that the first fruit there is referring back to the fathers, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. And so, they were pleasing in God's sight when they finally got through them and got them straightened out. And so the whole lump, that is, it's like putting some something in, mixing in your lump of dough, mixing it in, and it permeates the whole thing. And if the root be holy, so are the branches. And so getting back to practically the same figure again. Very much similar to it.